so everyone knows, we are broadcasting this to over the CCL Zoom line, and we've got about 10 folks here, so welcome all of you who are joining us remotely. I'm Ross Astoria, and I guess I'm the organizer of this shenanigan thing. This is Advanced Policy Bootcamp with Citizens Climate Lobby, and one of our awesome partners this year, Our Climate. And so we've got 2 days of experts coming in, and we are going to kind of spend our time looking at some of the more complicated and aspects of carbon pricing and how it interacts with different institutions on both the international and the domestic side. And one of our one thing that was really cool that has happened is we have one of our partners is the World Bank. And just 2 weeks ago, I think, maybe 3 weeks ago, the World Bank released its annual report on the state and trends of carbon pricing. And one of the authors of that report is able to join us today to give us the latest and greatest. It's hot off the presses. And so between the folks on the CCL line, there's about 10 there, and there's about 80 folks in the room. So we've got an audience of 90 or 100 people. And I'm going to introduce Dominic Englert really quickly. He's an economist at the World Bank, and he specializes in climate finance and mitigation. He is one of the authors of the report on the state and trends in carbon pricing. So with that, I'm going to let one thing Brett is reminding me to do. If you are on the joining us remotely, please submit your questions by using the chat box, and then we'll sort through those and ask them live. And also for people in the room, we're going to pass around 3x5 cards if you have questions, and we'll sort through those and ask questions for Dominic. So without, did I get to everything? All right, so without further ado, here's Dominic. Thank you, Dominic. Round of applause, please.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much, Ross. Thanks a lot, Brett, for the invitation. For us at the World Bank, it's a pleasure to be here. We highly value the cooperation that we have with the Citizens Climate Lobby and also with Our Climate. Ross has already given a short introduction about myself. I would like to do this in a different way, showing you a little bit what I'm doing in the World Bank or in the climate business in general. There are different perspectives to this. This is basically what my parents think I do. This is what the public usually thinks I do. This is what happens when the clicker is not working. My grandparents have another slight angle on my activities. Ecologists and my friends anyways. And I personally hope that I just can make a small contribution to saving our climate. This is, I think, what unites us all here in the room. Before I go on now, I would like to share a small disclaimer with you. Ross has been too nice saying that I've been one of the authors of the report. It's not totally wrong, but it's also not totally correct. I wrote small parts of the report, but small parts that actually will only become hopefully important in 5 to 10 years. My main topics that I'm working on is carbon pricing in the shipping sector, not existent yet, but big in the future. A carbon tax in the Ivory Coast in Africa would be the first carbon tax in a low-income country, also not existent yet, but probably hopefully big in the future. And another thing is carbon pricing in the livestock sector. Something that is being strongly opposed at the moment, but something that I and a lot of other colleagues try to make happen in the coming decades. So with this short disclaimer, just wanted to let you know that I'm not the full expert on all the figures and everything, all the details of all the carbon pricing initiatives that I'm going to present. So if there are slight mistakes or even some contradictory things, let me know and we can then look it up together in the report and ask my colleagues to make sure that everybody's on the same page. Okay, this is what I'm planning to do with you. First, I would like to present the state of play of carbon pricing today. So where do we stand? Basically, what is the state of play and what is currently going on? What has happened recently? In a second part, I would like to talk about the trends that we've identified that we are observing in carbon pricing. How is carbon pricing developing? Or where is it evolving to? And finally, it's about the international context. So how does carbon pricing fit in the international context of the Paris Agreement? Okay, I do it here. Or I don't do it at all. Last try. There we are, fantastic. Okay, state of carbon pricing initiatives around the world. What you see here is we've got currently 45 national jurisdictions and 25 subnational jurisdictions that are putting a price on carbon. This includes implemented and scheduled schemes, as well as schemes that are under consideration. You know, when I'm talking about schemes, this can be all kinds of schemes. The two main big types, carbon tax on emission trading system, but you also have got crediting mechanisms, result-based carbon finance, and so on and so on. So we are currently 45 national and 25 subnational jurisdictions. Thereof, 51 have already implemented or at least scheduled the date of implementation for their schemes. In total, these carbon pricing initiatives will cover 11 gigatons, up from 8 gigatons last year, the main difference being the Chinese national ETS, or what would be the equivalent of 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions, up from 15% from last year as well. This brings us closer to the vision and the goal that the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition pursues. The Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition is a voluntary initiative hosted by the World Bank that brings together leaders from global players, governments, businesses, and civil society that all share a common goal, that is to put a price on carbon. And this Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition, where Our Climate is a partner, the Citizens Climate Lobby is a partner, Yale University is a partner, and whoever isn't a partner yet can become a partner after the session. They support the vision that was formulated by the High-Level Commission on Carbon Pricing. High-Level Commission on Carbon Pricing consists of Angela Merkel in Germany, Justin Trudeau in Canada, at that point of time, François Hollande in France. Now it's Emmanuel Macron, Peña Nieto in Mexico, the wonderful president of Ethiopia, whose name I'm blanking on, unfortunately, and the mayor, Governor Jerry Brown in California, and the mayor of Rio de Janeiro. And they all share this common vision of covering 25% of global greenhouse gas emissions with a carbon price by 2020, and then once again, doubling this coverage to 50% within another decade. So, with the 20%, we are on a good way, but we don't have much time left. So we've got two more years. Let's see if we can make it to the 25%. Talking about coverage, we are now looking at the implemented and the scheduled carbon pricing initiatives around the globe. What you can see here is there is continued proliferation of carbon pricing initiatives all over the world. Over the past 10 years, the carbon pricing initiatives have tripled. You see several big jumps in terms of coverage. You see in 2005, there was the EU ETS coming in, covering 2 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions. In 2012, you had the Japanese carbon tax coming in, as well as the California cap and trade scheme. And in 2020, a major milestone, China has announced that it's going to launch its national ETS. Currently, China is operating 8 pilot ETSs in provinces and cities, but it's going to roll it out over the next years on a national level, covering 1,700 installations, factories. In the beginning, it's only going to start in the power sector, and covering their 3 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions, what is going to make the Chinese ETS the biggest carbon pricing initiative worldwide, even ahead of the EU scheme. What about, wonderful, exactly, this is always when you talk too fast, yeah. So I just mentioned this, exactly, 20% of global greenhouse gas emissions, up from 15% last year. So talking about prices in implemented carbon pricing initiatives. So what we see here in this graph, and I apologize for the people in the last row, it's not your outdated glasses, it's really just text font. I see also people in the first row have got difficulties, but we're going to study them very closely later together. Now, what you see here, prices vary substantially from less than 1 ton of CO2 equivalent to a maximum of to a maximum of $139 per ton of CO2 equivalent. By the way, there is a question. Up there, what you can't see, which is the jurisdiction with the highest carbon price currently? Sweden, fantastic. The gentleman over there was faster, and this entitles to you to a wonderful CBLC cap. Yeah. Pick it up later on, yeah? Sweden, exactly. Oh, there we have got. You even, exactly. So,
I was taking our service,
yeah? So we said so prices vary significantly. A big price jump we've seen over the past year was in the EU emission trading system, where last year prices were around $7 and now we are at $16. This is due to the fact that we now have some clarity how the EU emission trading system is going to work after 2020. So there is a decrease in the cap. They always had a linear reduction factor. It was at 1.74% and now it's going to be at 2.2%. Does the micro still work? Yeah? Fantastic. Okay. 2.2%. Also, the free allocation, so the emission allowances that installations get for free will also be further decreased, and most of the allowances at some point of time will be auctioned, what also creates shortage in the market and drives up prices. And a very important thing, and I'm going to talk more about it later, is the EU emission trading system introduced a market stability reserve that is going to suck out allowances out of the market that are not used. And if the surplus, currently we've got a huge surplus, if the surplus exceeds a certain threshold, what is already the case, these allowances will be invalidated and will not be available to the market anymore, what creates shortage and drives up prices. A very important phenomenon that you see here, where prices vary substantially. Nevertheless, you've got a good amount or the large majority of prices somewhere from close to zero to about $20. These are not the price levels that we want to see, but I'm going to talk about the price levels that we would like to see and that are necessary later on. Talking about prices and coverage, the good thing is that about half of the emissions are now covered, half of the carbon priced emissions are now covered by carbon pricing initiatives that price them at more than $10. This is up from last year. It was only one quarter of all carbon priced emissions had a carbon price associated with it that was higher than $10. These are the good news. The bad news is that about half of the emissions are covered at less than $1. So we still have a long way to go there until we increase prices. You see here once again that it's also the still the EU emission trading system down here that is somehow in between with regards to prices, but with regard to coverage is by far the most important that we have on the globe so far. Regarding the revenues, a very important aspect of carbon pricing as well. Governments were able to raise revenues in the order of magnitude of 33 billion in 2017. This is also up from 22 billion in 2016. The reason being the price increase in the EU ETS, as well as additional schemes that went online. Revenues are supposed to be a side effect, actually, of carbon pricing, although some economists and some politicians see this differently. But the most important thing is usually the price signal that carbon emissions should have a cost. For many governments, nevertheless, it's a very attractive, if not one of the most attractive incentives to engage in carbon pricing schemes. The biggest revenues that we see here were raised in the EU ETS, were raised in France, in Sweden, and then we also have got the Japan carbon tax down here. Also talking about coverage, you see on the x-axis that what's always the coverage that these different schemes cover in their respective jurisdictions. And that you see there are kind of three green bubbles that are pretty good in their coverage. So this means almost 80 to 90% of the emissions happening in these jurisdictions are covered by a carbon price. Does anybody know which bubbles these are, which jurisdictions? These three ones? Fantastic. Okay, there's the next cap that goes there. Wonderful, yeah?
What was the answer?
California, Quebec, and... Oh!
Go Jerry.
Exactly. Go Jerry Brown. Exactly. There you are.
What was the question?
Sorry. I apologize. Apparently, so my questioning is unfair because not everybody is familiar with my German accent. So the question was, so kind of, which are these three carbon pricing initiatives that almost cover 80 to 90%, so the highest share that we can observe here of emissions happening in their jurisdictions?
California, Quebec, and Ontario.
Oh, hey. We take this offline later on and we and we see kind of, we're going to auction the cap the next one. Yeah. So that much about the state of play of carbon pricing. And now I would like to briefly talk about the trends that we observe and that that are happening in the field of pricing. One trend that is clear and that is positive, carbon pricing initiatives continue to emerge and all over the world. Over the next year, we're gonna see the implementation of the of a carbon tax in Singapore. We're going to see the start of the South African carbon tax, as well as the implementation of a carbon tax in Argentina. And not to forget, for sure, the Chinese national ETS is going to go into its first infrastructure development phase.
Singapore, South Africa was the third one?
Singapore, South Africa, China, Argentina.
China.
Correct, yeah. And we hope for many others that are not, that haven't come out with their start date yet, but we hope that they're going to come out also at some point in time. Yeah. But we also see that prices are slowly increasing. I told you about the EU ETS price from $7 to $16. But we still need to do more, and we still need higher prices in order to be in line with the emission reduction pathways that are foreseen by the Paris Agreement in order to keep temperature rise well below 2 degrees, or hopefully reach even 1.5 degrees temperature rise only. There, I would like to know, does anybody know what the so-called high-level commission on carbon prices led by Nobel Prize laureate Joseph Stiglitz and Lord Nicholas Stern, what are the price levels that they recommend for 2020?
40, 30, 40, 30, 40, 30, 40, 30.
There is a lower threshold and a higher threshold. Let's talk about the lower threshold. What are the minimum price that they recommend?
40.
40, damn. Damn, there are too many people. I would say, okay. You're fully right with the 40. This gives a cap to, I think now we play the lottery, basically. Okay. You see the problem with carbon pricing, although some economists assume it, it's not always fair. So I apologize. The next.
She already has a hat.
She already has one. Oh yeah, that's okay. I can't see this one. And what are the prices that they recommend for 2050? Sorry, for 2030, I apologize. 10 years only later, yeah?
140.
140? 75? 80? We're talking once again about the lower threshold, and I love your optimism and I love your confidence and so on. But it's only 50 to 100. So that's the good thing. So we only have to get to 50. We're still far away from this in order to be in line with the Paris Agreement. Although this assumes that all emissions worldwide would be priced at this price level, what makes it pretty challenging again. Other trends that we observe. So carbon pricing initiatives can serve multiple environmental and social goals. So the main goal, the main objective, the easiest mechanism is always there in order to discourage emitting greenhouse gas emissions, sending a clear price signal that polluting has got its price. But at the same time, there are a lot of jurisdictions out there that also implement carbon pricing initiatives for other reasons. For example, Singapore clearly states, and also Korea, that carbon pricing initiatives are there to stimulate low carbon innovation. So kind of really make sure that there is a clear incentive to invest into innovation, new technologies that can do the same with fewer emissions. As far as China is concerned, for example, especially the Beijing emission trading system clearly states that their ETS aims also at improving the air quality in the city. They've got a big smog issue. And they also hope that the carbon pricing initiative or the emission trading system that they have contributes to the air quality within the city. something what we also observe, there are a lot of deviations from the original plan in many carbon pricing initiatives. Examples are, for example, South Africa, the carbon tax has been discussed now over, I think, 3-4 years already, and it got rescheduled, got a little bit modified, adjusted, reformed, and so on. Hopefully, it's going to start now, beginning of 2019. Australia was an unfortunate example. They had already introduced the carbon price that was then repealed by the and this carbon price was even linked then to the carbon pricing scheme to the EU emission trading system, what would have been a major carbon pricing system on a global scale, but was repealed by the government. We also see that Washington State introduced emission trading system last year, but was challenged by the court, saying that the EPA there didn't have the authority to regulate suppliers of natural gas and petroleum products because they were not the direct emitters of these greenhouse gas emissions. So, and the biggest example is something where deviations occur, are often observed is when there is market imbalance. So market imbalance, something that I've just talked about in the EU emission trading system, where you've got way more supply than you predicted and not that much of a demand. How does this happen? It happens usually when you've got other policies that interact with carbon pricing. You've got policies like subsidies for renewable energies, like feed-in tariffs and so on, that are a great idea and that are very important to complement carbon prices. But unfortunately, the fewer, kind of the more electricity is generated through renewable energies that are promoted through feed-in tariffs and so on, the more allowances in a cap and trade scheme are available on the market for kind of the dirty sources, the fossil fuel sources, driving prices down. Other issues that we've observed in Europe is the financial crisis in the years 2008, 2009, 2010, that led to an economic downturn. So companies produced less products, consumed less energy, and so on, had fewer emissions. What means kind of why should they go on the market and buy emission allowances if they have only few emissions now? Nevertheless, kind of the auction schedule and the free allocation was set before or defined before, what led to a surplus in the market. Jurisdictions try to fix this problem now with so-called market stability reserves. As I said, the EU ETS will have one. REGI here, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, is also going to have one. That is basically a kind of like an account, as I said, that sucks out surplus allowances out of the market when there are too many unused ones, and also works in the other direction when there's shortage and there is a risk that prices might skyrocket in the future. Then it releases additional allowances from the reserve and makes sure that there's enough supply on the market and that companies will not go bankrupt because they have to buy additional emission allowances. There we are. Closely linked to this is that jurisdictions, almost all jurisdictions, especially in emission trading systems, they use a phased approach to plan for changes. For example, the EU ETS is going to go into its fourth phase now. California is going to go into its post-2020 phase now. And these phases are very important because they balance kind of two needs. They balance the need of the government to be flexible, to be agile, and to make adjustments along the way with the need of businesses that need predictability. I mean, they need to know what kind of rules will be valid over the next 5 to 8 years or so. Knowing that kind of the rules are fixed for one phase is a good thing. And then in the next phase, be it the fourth phase or the second phase or so on, in the next phase, it is then possible for the legislator to make some adjustments and to make sure that smaller issues or bigger issues in this case, like the surplus on the market and so on, can be corrected. Also, some positive trends is that internal carbon pricing is becoming a more and more popular tool for climate-related financial disclosure. What you see here is the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. It's a task force led by Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England. And they were tasked with the mission to develop recommendations for how to deal better with climate-related financial disclosures. They were tasked by the G20, so the kind of biggest, the 20 biggest economies worldwide, with the idea really kind of how can financial institutions better manage their climate-related risks. And one of their, or some of their recommendations are closely related to carbon pricing, saying internal carbon pricing, when financial institutions apply internally a price on carbon, they can basically see in a language that is money, kind of see for themselves what kind of risks they might have in their portfolios and what kind of risks might be involved in funding or financing specific projects. We also see cooperation going on, more and more cooperation between governmental players, between business players, but also between civil society. And this is a good development, so this can accelerate implementation and also raise ambition. May I ask, does anybody know of an example between cooperation between governments, governments on their carbon pricing initiatives that are not linked yet? So no chance for Ontario, Quebec and California, but one that is not linked yet, but where we know that there is cooperation going on. Norway. I mean, Norway is linked to the Norway is part of the EU ETS yet. Yeah. Some examples that we see is so kind of fantastic. Oh, there I get rid of my cap. Yeah. Switzerland and the EU are a good example. They basically decided that they have finished with the technical discussions, and they've decided that they are going to link their schemes. Now it has to go through through the parliament, that basically there is an interchangeability between Swiss emission allowances and EU emission allowances. Other examples are, there's also dialogue going on between Canada and China. It's at the very early and nascent stages, but they are discussing ideas of cooperation. In the Americas, we saw at the One Planet Summit that was hosted by Emmanuel Macron and the World Bank President and the United Nations Secretary General last year in Paris, we saw also a declaration of the Americas, so 12 national and subnational jurisdictions in the Americas, North America and South America, stated their will to cooperate on carbon prices. And there's also a very promising development, I mean, has been going on now for a while already, between South Korea, Japan and China, also with the idea of one day kind of working closer together in on carbon pricing. Another thing, new technology. New technology can help us and will hopefully help us to make these kind of more heterogeneous, bottom-up and decentralized markets that are currently emerging more compatible and connect them to each other. There is new technology. There is, for example, There's, for example, blockchain. Blockchain cannot only be used for currencies, as everybody knows here who has got bitcoins, but can also be used for any other kind of ledgers or registries. What will be very important under the Paris Agreement, and I'll talk about this in a minute, where it's important that emissions are not counted twice, and especially emission reductions are not counted twice. What would be total nonsense. Also, satellite sensors and so on kind of are getting better and better and are getting into the direction that one day we hopefully they can help us to significantly improve the current monitoring, reporting, verification practices that we have that are mainly based on calculation. Once we get to the point where it can really be measured scientifically, this is going to first make everybody's life easier. Second, also help to prevent fraud. And finally, implicit carbon pricing and divestment efforts positively interact with carbon pricing. And in this context, I want to talk briefly about the case of negative carbon pricing that also exists. Negative carbon pricing, may I ask, who knows what, who can give a good example for negative carbon pricing?
Subsidy.
Wonderful, yeah.
Offsets for forestry and things like
that. There is.
Carbon sequestration.
What do I do now? I mean, but he is kind of, he's going to be angry about me if I don't give it to him now. Exactly. There are kind of subsidies, especially for fossil fuels. The idea, it was in a few years ago, it was $230 billion that only the G20, so the 20 major economies worldwide used or mobilized in order to support the use of coal, oil, and gas. And getting rid of them, reducing them, and phasing them out is basically as effective, if not even more effective and cheaper, much cheaper than basically introducing a carbon price. Okay, last part, and then you are done with me, and then hopefully you can get rid of me very soon. Talking about carbon pricing in the Paris Agreement. So how does it fit in there? What we see here, so the Paris Agreement, there are 197 parties to it. Out of these, 195 have already have signed it. Very last chance for a CPLC cap. Which two countries haven't signed the Paris Agreement yet?
Nicaragua.
I think we have to cut this cap into several different pieces. The United States have signed it, and they are still in. They are still in. Kind of, you can only get out. When is it? 2020. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly, and let's see if you might not get in right away again. So it is Nicaragua and Syria. Nicaragua deposited the ratification. They said they're gonna ratify it, but they have not even signed it yet. So kind of, but basically tricky one. Basically, they were. Okay, I barely apologize. I would say I've got two spare ones as well, and they might go later on in a non-democratic way to the rare tables, if this is okay. As I said, carbon pricing is not always fair. So, so Nicaragua and Syria, exactly. Out of those, 175 have ratified it already. 169 have submitted the so-called nationally determined contributions. And in these nationally determined contributions that are nothing else than basically the national climate plans stating how they want to contribute to the fight against climate change in terms of mitigation as well as adaptation. 88 make a reference to carbon pricing, and 88 of these NDCs cover 56% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. The picture is not completely accurate. There are also some NDCs by countries that already make good use and significant use of carbon pricing and that simply don't mention carbon pricing in the NDC. A good example is the European Union that has got the biggest emission trading system, but they just don't refer to it in the NDCs. In the Paris Agreement, carbon pricing is made possible or included in the form of Article 6. And in Article 6, you've got the Article 6.2, the so-called International Transferable Mitigation Outcomes, ITMOs. The Article 6.2 talks about ITMOs and about cooperative approaches, enabling countries to achieve their emission reduction targets together. And these emission reduction targets... Mike, okay.
It may be the battery, I'll just hand you this one. Sorry about that.
All right, okay, then we are flexible there. Thank you, Brett. The emission reduction targets, achieving them together, cooperating, and basically with the idea that one country or several countries can reduce on behalf of other countries. The big issue is here then to avoid what I've already said, kind of to make this fully transparent and to avoid double counting, so that we don't end up with in a situation where country A basically reduces whatever 5 million tons, and then once counts it for their own emission reduction targets, and then at the same time sells it to country B, and they will be counted the second time, what will lead us to a situation where we basically have an accounting system that is totally weird and totally nonsense. There's another article under the Paris Agreement, it's Article 6.4, that talks about the so-called Sustainable Development Mechanism. The Sustainable Development Mechanism is supposed to be a kind of program, project-related mechanism where players can invest in emission reduction activities and then get emission reductions issued by the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that are then valid and are then legitimate emission reductions that can be traded worldwide. It's not fully clear yet to what extent these outcomes of sustainable development mechanism might also be traded on as international transferable mitigation outcomes. There are currently a lot of experts under the UNFCCC. The last negotiation round took place a month ago in Bonn. They are discussing these opportunities, and they have the goal of basically coming up with guidelines by the next conference of the parties in Poland in November 2014. And another thing that is not clear yet, many of you might have heard already of the Clean Development Mechanism that has been out there for quite a while. And to what extent the SDG, the Sustainable Development Mechanism, might build on this Clean Development Mechanism or might completely replace it and create something new. Everything is in the air and everything is still possible. They are currently drafting the rule book with the guidelines for the implementation of Article 6 under the Paris Agreement. So my last two slides were... This is not in our last report, so not in the 2008 report, but in the 2016 report. We were sitting down and we were calculating what would be the benefits in terms of cost savings if there was a global carbon price worldwide, and all jurisdictions would be entitled kind of to trade emission reductions fully between themselves. And the outcome there was, if all these carbon pricing initiatives worldwide were linked to each other, there would be a minus 32% of cost savings if we wanted to achieve all the emission reductions, all the NDCs under the Paris Agreement by 2030. And if we go 20 years later, by 2050, there would even be cost savings of one half if countries were able to trade all their emission reductions freely among themselves. What means kind of we can achieve significant cost savings there if we enable trading and linking. And at the same time, always the argument is always kind of that poorer countries do not benefit from carbon pricing. What we see here is, for example, Africa or South America will have a significant net inflow of money into their regions because it will be much cheaper to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in their regions than it might be in the United States or might be in Europe or might be in parts of Asia. So coming to my very last point, that is the conclusion or the summary. Basically, all the points that I've just made, we said there are 88 NDCs that refer to carbon pricing, covering 56% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. Currently, we've got 45 national, 25 subnational carbon pricing initiatives on our radar. 51 of them have already been implemented and or scheduled. This corresponds to 11 gigatons of global greenhouse gas emissions being covered, or 20% of the world's emissions. Prices vary substantially between $1 and $139, with about half of the emissions above half of the emissions being priced at more than $10 and half of the emissions being priced at less than $10. Revenues raised $33 billion by governments that can be used for different purposes. Usually kind of a rough estimate is, but there we are also going to have a study, a more detailed study on this, is 50% of the revenues are more or less used earmarked very often for climate-friendly projects. Other 50% go to the general budget or are being redistributed to the population. And in total, the value of carbon pricing initiatives in 2018 was $82 billion. Under the Paris Agreement, we've got one main article that deals with carbon pricing, Article 6, with its two sub-articles. 6.2 for international transferable mitigation outcomes, so these cooperative approaches, and 6.4, the sustainable development mechanism. And if we were able to implement full international trading for emission reductions under the Paris Agreement, we would be able to achieve cost savings on a global scale of minus 32% by 2030 or 50% by 2025. That's from my side, and I forgot something. If you want to get always the most up-to-date information on carbon pricing, and you don't want to wait another year until we publish the next annual report, don't hesitate to go to the so-called carbonpricingdashboard.worldbank.org, where you find the same information in interactive graphs and maps and so on. Always, I think it's, I don't know what the update schedule is exactly, but I assume that it's updated at least on a monthly basis, where you really find all the information, kind of what are the current price levels, what's the coverage, what's the allocation methodology, and so on and so on. carbonpricing-dashboard.worldbank.org. And if you don't find the information there, I will give my card to you. Or there's also a wonderful email address where my colleagues get an email with your request and we'll get back to you as quickly as possible. Thanks a lot for your attention. And now I'm looking forward to your questions.
Yeah, so many questions. First off, can actually people hear me with this new mic? Yeah, they're not. Right. So I've got so many questions that I need a table. So if you don't have your card collected, please go over back to me. But we've got over 30 questions. And at this point, I know that Dominic's original time was going to be done in about 11 minutes. But Ross has said that he's happy to allow more time. So at this point, let's have about 25, 30 minutes for Q&A. And then we'll have a 10-minute break. But that being said, then what we'll need to do, if it's all right with you, Dominic, is practice lightning questions. So I'm trying to group these together. And again, if we don't get to all of the full details, the answers, Dominic is generously offering to be available for anyone that wants to have lunch together afterwards too. But let's practice about a minute or so for each question. Is that all right?
Lightning answers means I can say yes, no, or maybe, or.
If you can, good luck. All right, so let's kick things off here again. And there's a theme a couple of people have asked, and I think the one that says it the best here is actually with our live attendees on CCU, and that is this, Dominic. What is your recommendation for the best analysis out there on showing that actual carbon prices stimulate action to reduce emissions? Where do you find kind of the most evidence that this relationship actually is causal rather than correlational?
You start with the toughest question. Thank you very much, Brad. No, the problem is really, and that's something that we are working on in the World Bank, the problem is really we would like to provide the empirical evidence. The issue at the moment is with the current price levels, mainly between $0 and $20, it is very difficult to prove the direct correlation between carbon pricing and stimulation of low carbon innovation. I can only, this is totally non-scientific, but we are working on this and we try to figure this out, but it must be, we need higher price levels really to prove the correlation. I can only share with you a totally personal, non-scientific example. Before joining the World Bank, I worked for 5 years in Europe, consulting and advising multinational companies on how to behave and how to play in the emission trading system in Switzerland and in Europe. And the fact that some companies that had never dealt with carbon dioxide before, greenhouse gas emissions in general, suddenly were faced with a carbon price, and that at that point of time the carbon price was pretty low. We are talking about $5-6. I mean, for their books, I mean, it's ridiculous. Already this effect that it suddenly it had a price made them think and made them become so creative and so interested in the topic. And they were coming up with lots of great ideas how they could reduce carbon pricing. It was basically, if they had done the math properly, I would say they would have probably sat down and said, okay, probably at $5, we don't have to do that much. But just already the psychological effect was so tremendous that they spent hours, days and weeks really thinking about options, how to avoid this new carbon price, regardless of its price level.
Excellent. And I'll just say for all the young scholars in the room, this is precisely the intersection that we need all of your voices on. So, I mean, policy only happens because people put the time to research it. If you've got ideas, throw them out there in your own home institutions. That's what I'm working on in my program. I'd love to talk else afterwards offline too, because this is a huge gap that we need more evidence behind. And the next question on this, Dominic, connected to that, there's a lot of referencing between greenhouse gases and carbon pricing used interchangeably. Do all or some of these prices actually put equivalencies on methane and other greenhouse gases, or are they pretty much focused just on pricing carbon alone?
Most of the time, it's CO2 that is priced so carbon dioxide. I don't know of many schemes that also price methane. I know of in the EU they also price N2O, so nitrous oxide, nitrous oxide. They also price PFC, what is the English for fluorocarbons, exactly, yeah. But it's really mainly carbon dioxide. Methane, we are always we are very quickly in the agricultural sector, or we are in the waste sector, and that's the agricultural sector. There's only one carbon pricing scheme out there that actually deals with the agricultural sector, and that is New Zealand. So otherwise, it's really mainly carbon dioxide, although they are thinking about extending the coverage in different schemes.
All right, so this is a larger kind of question, twofold, a couple of questions grouped together on it. Do you see, looking forward, a more kind of continual, fractured, unilateral carbon pricing scheme or approach, or do you see countries coming together to really cooperate and create a few far-reaching policies collectively? And connected to that, with the current approach, how do you see subnational carbon pricing influencing these national policies?
Very good question, I see both. I mean, under the Kyoto Protocol, was very much top-down, centralized approaches, and there was no flexibility for anything else. This didn't work out very well. So on the Paris Agreement, it has really encouraged kind of bottom-up, decentralized, heterogeneous action. What makes it more difficult than to link them, but nevertheless, what we see, I mean, we see it with the EU in Switzerland, we see it with Ontario, California, and Quebec. We also saw it at some point of time between Australia and the EU. We see it now in the Americas, where the Pacific Alliance consists of Peru, Colombia, Mexico, and Chile. They also want to create a common, either common tax or common market scheme. There are possibilities, so we will see both the emergence of kind of more heterogeneous, decentralized schemes, but also in order to achieve these cost savings that I refer to, the intent to link these schemes. And it's not only about cost savings, it's also about a big concern, and we are also working on a report on this, is always a loss of competitiveness. And this loss of competitiveness, or this fear of a loss of competitiveness, let's call it that way, can be countered, basically creating a level playing field and applying the same price in all jurisdictions. Subnational action is great and is also encouraged by the and is also possible under the Paris Agreement. And we see more and more subnational action coming out there, especially in the field of emission trading systems. It is that most of the carbon taxes are actually done by national governments, but most of the ETSs actually come from subnational jurisdictions.
All right, so we have a whole bucket of ETS questions. That's a perfect segue. First off, why do we use the word scheme? Why don't we use the word system or another S word? Scheme just kind of seems meddling.
That's a very good question, and I think even the European Union is sometimes not fully sure about how they want to call their thing. No, because ETS is basically, I mean, can be the acronym for emission trading system or emission trading scheme, and it's really used interchangeably. I find scheme a little bit more neutral, a little bit more kind of scientific, but system is as fine. There is really no difference. If anybody else wants to make a third suggestion that starts with S, I'm also more than willing to use this one.
There might be a cat for that. All right, so what about this for ETSs? Why, in your opinion, have so many jurisdictions chosen them given their expense and complexity of setting up?
Can you repeat the question, please?
So comparing different carbon pricing approaches, why do you think the majority of the world systems currently at least utilize ETSs versus the direct carbon tax? What's favorable about governments going the ETS route?
I think we've also gone through an important learning experience here. When all these discussions about carbon pricing came up in the early 2000s, and the US was still heavily involved, the US kind of pursued much more this market-based approach, much more markets, we need emission trading systems and so on, and the Europeans were actually much more in favor of a tax. Then later on, the US push never materialized, or the US plans never materialized, and somehow the Europeans kind of shifted to an emission trading systems. The reasons being that businesses pushed for it. For businesses, it is something where they are basically. Where they feel more comfortable with. It is something that they understand. They compete on markets anyways, and now it's simply another market that they have to compete, and they are fine with this idea. The second thing is a political one. A tax is always, and I think that's especially true here in the United States, always considered as something that is somehow bad and comes from big government and so on. While a market approach is, exactly something that we can live on, and then we can outsmart the market. It's difficult to outsmart the tax. So it's more really kind of this political perception of a tax. And the third thing is a more regulatory legal issue. I'm not a lawyer myself, but I think the European Union doesn't have the authority to introduce a tax on the kind of regional European level.
Excellent. I was going to go one direction, but given that, let's go this way. So speaking of Europe and their current framework, this is maybe something you're just speaking to right now. If you want to go a little bit more in depth, there's two questions. Why can Sweden and France then on the national level have a high carbon tax while Germany hasn't? And then connected to that, how might carbon pricing affect trade imbalances between neighboring countries with different profiles like France and Germany?
I mean, they can, Sweden and France, they have got this carbon tax for emissions that are not part of the EU emission trading system. So they basically cover all other, the so-called non-air ETS emissions. Although the UK, for example, has got a kind of a carbon tax that is for the power sector, that is more or less like basically a carbon price floor for power plants. So whatever emissions, I don't know what is the carbon price floor. I think it's something like 10 pounds or 12 pounds or 15 pounds. I would have to check. Whenever the kind of the price for emission allowances is below this price floor, basically power plants have to submit emission allowances plus the difference to make up this price gap. Why doesn't Germany have it? I'm going to ask Angela next time when I talk to her. There are many bad reasons why there are a lot of things that would make sense why we don't have them in Germany. It's just kind of although we are among the we want to be among the climate pioneers, we still somehow are deeply in love with our industry and also with our power sector that is, to a certain extent, still relies heavily on lignite.
Thank you. So connected to that, then, one last European EU question. How does Switzerland design their linkage to the EU's overall kind of ETS when their price is so much higher and the EU's is so much lower?
That's a funny question. It's my favorite question. Thank you very much. I worked in Switzerland for 5 years, I actually worked with the Ministry of Environment introducing this Swiss emission trading system. And although the Swiss will never say so, but it's basically, it's a one-to-one copy of the EU emission trading system with kind of some Swissness attached to it. So mainly 0.5% of the rules are different, but otherwise it's a one-to-one copy to make it compatible with the EU emission trading system and to link it. And the funny thing is that, so, and this has a political reason, because Switzerland is not part of the European Union. So adopting something in Switzerland, or kind of just taking something from the European Union and saying we are part of this European Union activity or thing here, is something that is politically impossible in Switzerland. I mean, they insist on their independence and things must be done the Swiss way and so on, although the Swiss way in the end is exactly the same as the European way, but it's still the Swiss way. In terms of price levels, when I worked with all the companies in Switzerland, there was the big thing, we're going to have prices of whatever, $40 here, $50 here. And in the EU, it's only prices of $4 or $5 that's going to destroy our whole industry, and we're going to go bankrupt. And basically, what are we going to do with it? We have to sell our cows and our chocolate and all this. The funny thing is, it's just 2 days ago when I did some research on this again. So we've got price levels in the EU because the EU has become much more ambitious now. In its fourth phase post 2020, we've got price levels of, as we said, $16. The price level in Switzerland is currently at $7. So while companies have lobbied all the time the government, we need the linking to the EU emission trading system as quickly as possible, because otherwise our kind of price levels are so high, and we need access to cheap European emission allowances. I'm pretty sure that they are currently all queuing up in Bern, in the capital, at the parliament, say, okay, drop this idea of linking, and let's stick to the price levels of $7 that we have at the moment.
All right, we only have 10 minutes left for Q&A, and I know we still have about 20 questions, so we'll do our best to get to as many as we can, and again, we'll have time with Dominic. Well, what, in your opinion, have been the drawbacks of California's ETS, or their cap and trade policy, and where do you see the potential for iterations of this on a domestic or global level?
From a European perspective, or?
I guess just so on the domestic level, do you see that being adopted, or having good things or mainly drawbacks? And then on a global level, do you think the design is comparable to a lot of the other ETSs?
I really have to apologize. I'm not a big expert of the California cap and trade scheme. I know that they use kind of similar methodology for free allocation, like the kind of efficiency benchmarks that were also used in the EU emission trading system. But otherwise, I'm really not a big expert on this. I have to pause.
No,
I apologize.
All experts on everything. Let's go in another country. All right, so there's five on China. Do you feel comfortable with China, or should we do a different topic?
Let's see.
All right. So what's going on with China? It announced that it have a national carbon price by the end of 2017. Now it's 2020. Is it credible, and what kind of structuring is actually going on this year?
That's true. I mean, we had actually hoped for the China national ETS to be already running now, and it was pretty ambitious. The original plans were even that it would get us to a kind of global coverage of currently, as I said, 20%. In the beginning, it was meant even to be 8 billion tons, so bringing us to 25% worldwide. Now the Chinese also realized what they are pretty risk averse, and they don't want to make the same mistakes that the European Union made, for example, where then later on you have to introduce a market stability reserve and you have to think about the allocation methodology and all this stuff. So they rather want to do it slowly, and it's a huge thing. I mean, and it's a huge thing. I don't know how many thousands of installations they would have to cover. They basically want to do it carefully, and they want to make sure that everything is in place before they launch it correctly. And what also makes it challenging, they've got already these 8 pilot schemes that are running nicely, but they have to be integrated somehow into the national schemes. And you can also imagine that in China there are also lots of business interests involved, where businesses are also lobbying for one rule against another rule and so on. We really think that it's going to come. We are very confident. We are highly welcome what the Chinese are doing there. I would personally like to see it earlier, but nevertheless, I rather want to see that it happens kind of a little bit slower than that it doesn't happen at all.
So helpful. All right, so last two on China, one of which is, how do you see China's exporting coal to through developing world countries, majority world countries playing into this dynamic? And connected to that are actually quite different, but I'm just going to put them together. So no Chinese ETS currently operates in a way that this question asker says effectively limits credits and maintains high enough prices. From the World Bank or others' research, are those credits dispersed fairly, or do they tend to favor things like government-owned industries?
The next two questions, Brett, please. My insights are not deep enough to provide a good answer.
No, that's much appreciated, and obviously those are both important questions that we'll try to keep getting from the bottom up. So here's a broader, we've got two themes left that we'll get to, one of which is this overall scope of the whole regime internationally. What price or percent of emissions would meet the Paris 1.5 degree Celsius target again? What would that target need to be in order to achieve that target?
What price? That's a good question. I'm not sure if anybody has ever done the analytics. I mean, we know that currently with the current NDCs, we are heading towards a kind of 3 degrees Celsius target. In order to get to 2 degrees, we know the price level is kind of 40 to 80, 50. To 100. For the 1.5, I have no information, unfortunately.
Okay, no problem. Another great research there. So at this point, two of these questions kind of are getting at this 20% of coverage roughly that we've been talking about, one of which is asking, so when we say 20% is covered, is that the equivalent of a 20% reduction in emissions eventually? And then also, is 20% really accurate, or is it somewhat misleading in terms of real-world impact in reducing output, given that not all ETSs are created equal?
I mean, the 20% coverage is pretty straightforward. It has nothing to do with emissions trading. It has nothing to do with emission reduction. It just means that 20% of the global greenhouse gas emissions are somehow priced. It doesn't say if the price is less than a dollar or if the price is the Swedish carbon tax of $139. So it's just somehow somebody will be asked to pay for these emissions. And what was the second question?
Is this misleading due to the fact that not all ETSs are created equal, to lump them all in one basket and call them equally covered?
Yeah, but I mean, the idea is really kind of, we look here at kind of individual tons of CO2 equivalent. And when you look at these individual tons of CO2 equivalent that are either are priced under emission trading system or under a carbon tax system or under a carbon tax, then basically there the idea is really when you add up these individual tons of CO2 equivalent, you get to 20% of the global greenhouse gas emissions, independently from the price, independently of the monetary mechanism and so on, just the fact that that are being priced.
All right, excellent. Last segment here, and then we'll go to a break. This is kind of on measurement and verification. Has there been any progress on leakage prevention mechanisms agreements among other countries outside of these carbon pricing dialogues?
What is meant by leakage provisions in this case?
This leakage prevention, in that are some countries actually talking with each other and sharing information on how they're preventing methane leakage from their own pipeline and oil and gas?
Not that kind of leakage. Carbon, I think that was my question. It was things like carbon border adjustments or output-based allocation, those sorts of mechanisms.
Yeah, I mean, there's something that we've been working on is the idea of, and I think, I unfortunately missed Ross' presentation, but there's something that we work on consumption-based carbon pricing. So really the idea of making sure that whatever kind of gray emissions you might import are being priced at the border through consumption-based carbon pricing. I've got, Ross doesn't know about it, I've got an executive briefing on this topic out there that I would like to share with you afterwards, and where you can really read about the idea of consumption-based carbon pricing. The problem, the concept has always been controversial, as the argument was, oh, this might not be WTO compatible. We've got experts that say it is WTO compatible, or it can be made WTO compatible. And the other argument was always, oh, but this might actually trigger trade wars. And recently a friend has come up and has said, we're going to have the trade wars anyway, so let's do consumption-based carbon pricing.
Excellent. We'll do one more serious question here. And then again, if your question wasn't answered, I apologize. I'm trying to lump all these together, but please see Dominic at lunch. And this is the last question. Are there policies in place that you know of that really do a good job in guaranteeing that those revenues that are collected actually go to offset carbon costs and externalities? That really kind of safeguard it being rated by other government funds or interests?
I mean, it is really, there are so different approaches and here to the use of revenues. And we are actually doing a big study on this, kind of what jurisdictions do with the revenues. As I said, you can either really earmark them for specific purposes. And among these purposes, it's not only investments in clean technology, it might be also kind of lump sum transfers. It's also the idea of that CCL is promoting of a dividend and so on, or also kind of helping low-income households with their electricity bills. But there are also as many arguments speaking in favor of just kind of using it in order to reduce distortionary taxes, like taxes on labor and so on. Or basically, in the end, just redistributing it to the population in general. There are so many different pros and cons. I would really would like to share with all of you as soon as this study is out. I hope in the coming months, there will be then lots of analysis done on this issue of how are revenues being used and what are the most what makes the most sense in using revenues smartly.
Excellent. All right, so for a little bit of levity, let's close with this question. Where can I buy one of those hats you're giving away?
It's very simple. You go to www.dominicsonlinecapshop.com. Yeah? You put in your bid. I think the starting bid is something like 4 digits, or and then in the end, if I see more than 10 bids, kind of in the 4-digit area, kind of we might have a lottery. So.
Dr. Kenny Drake. So